The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources, and let's start with an article from AARP, the magazine, How We Eat, the Changing American Table. Food is relatively cheap and plentiful these days, but, asks the writer, is it as tasty and healthful as it was 60 years ago? I've been writing about food for 50 years, yet it took the COVID-19 crisis to show me just how much I didn't know. Facing empty supermarket shelves for the first time in my life, I reached out to the people who keep us fed. As I spoke with farmers, fishermen, ranchers, chefs, and cheesemakers, I finally began to understand how our food system really works. Here's the thing. We are all aware that our food tastes have changed. We know that Americans now eat more salsa than ketchup, and that ramen is as familiar as Campbell's tomato soup. Still, when it comes to the basics, we tend to believe that we're eating pretty much the same food that our grandparents did. Consider Thanksgiving dinner. Since 1963, when Abraham Lincoln declared Thanksgiving a national holiday, Americans everywhere have been sitting down to roast turkey, stuffing, and mashed potatoes. This tastes just like my grandmother's, my husband says every year, as we revel in the fact that we are literally eating history. His memory is playing tricks on him. The food on my table and yours does not resemble in any way what our ancestors once ate. A turkey hatched 50 years ago would look with deep suspicion at that bird you're carving. The farmer of the past would barely recognize the potatoes on your plate, and the wheat in the bread we use for stuffing is nothing like the amber grains on the plains of the past. American food is being transformed at such a rapid pace that a few years from now, it's entirely possible our turkeys will no longer even be hatched from eggs. Although I may not remember how Grandma's food tasted, I certainly remember her complaining about its cost. Little wonder, as almost a third of her household budget went to feed the family. Since then, food prices have come down so dramatically that average Americans spend a mere 7% of their budget on it, less than people spend in any other nation on earth. That seems like progress, but just look at us. 3/4 of us are overweight, and 6 out of 10 of us suffer from chronic illnesses such as diabetes, heart disease, asthma, and hepatitis. Does our cheap food have anything to do with that? Looking for answers, I turned back the clock. When I was growing up in Connecticut, my mother bought corn, poultry, and tomatoes from the farm next door. Our milk came from the London dairy down the road. The farm is gone, and the dairy is now a golf course. But I never gave much thought to why they disappeared. It was not, as it turns out, an accident. And this article I need to tell you is by Ruth Reichel. As we entered World War II, almost 1/4 of Americans were employed in farming. After the war ended and the Cold War began, our government decided that growing bigger, better, and substantially more food than the Soviets did would be a great way to spread democracy. They began by converting into fertilizer the enormous stockpile of aluminum nitrate left over from the explosives program. The new nitrate-rich fertilizer dramatically increased productivity. Meanwhile, new labor-saving machines replaced inefficient horses, and progressive plant breeding improved yields. Scientific advances, such as the use of antibiotics to make animals grow faster, were also introduced. By 1960, our farms had become so efficient that fewer farmers were able to grow significantly more food, and farmers dwindled to 9% of the population. Small farms were gobbled up by bigger ones, and in suburban America, farms began to vanish. Urban dwellers barely noticed. But we were starting to lose touch with the way our food was grown. Things that go bad, that 10 years ago when I handed a cucumber to a New York City kid, he looked at it with wonder. "What's that?" he said. But we weren't losing just farms. My family used to pile into Dad's old woody station wagon every summer, stopping to eat at local restaurants as we drove across the country. I remember my first taste of Rhode Island stuffies and the thrill of Iowa loose meat sandwiches. And as we drove to South Carolina, I repeated the words, Frogmore stew, over and over, wondering what that regional specialty would taste like. Those trips ended in the 60s. Restaurants that served those dishes began to close, and road trips were a lot less fun when the only dining places left served fast food. Americans had chosen consistency over tradition. Yet, we lost more than regional flavors. We lost some of the glue that held rural America together. Efficiency also invaded our homes. In the early 50s, Poppy Cannon's The Can Opener Cookbook charged onto the bestseller list with its suggestions for fast, easy family meals. When Mom became a fan, Dad and I began to dread dinner. I recently looked up the recipe for one of her favorite dishes, casserole a la king. It turned out to be canned macaroni and cheese mixed with canned chicken a la king and topped with grated cheese, breadcrumbs, and butter. Did Mom really think it was palatable? Did anyone? I expect that much of Poppy's success was due to her promoting her specious theories on America's favorite new medium, television. But she was just a sign of the times. By the mid-50s, most American kitchens were equipped with refrigerators, and housewives filled their new freezers with three iconic foods of that moment: TV dinners, fish sticks, and tater tots. Frankly, after Poppy Cannon's concoctions, they were a thrill. Those chicken TV dinners with their peas and mashed potatoes were some of the best meals Mom ever made. What we want is to make life more easy for our housewives, Vice President Richard Nixon told Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev in the famous kitchen debates of 1959. My mother and legions of other women led Nixon to this word, or held Nixon to his word. For them, every TV dinner took too much time. Instant became my mother's favorite word as she happily embraced an entirely new group of foods designed to get her out of the kitchen quickly. Instant mashed potatoes, freeze-dried instant coffee, Pop-Tarts, Tang, and of course, Carnation instant breakfast began to line our cupboard shelves. Mom bragged she could get dinner on the table in 15 minutes flat. Some people had second thoughts about all of this. The price of air travel had dropped dramatically, and hordes of American tourists went off to explore Europe and other parts of the world on $5 a day. They came home hungry for the delicious foods they had tasted on their travels. Julia Child was there to help. This book, she wrote in the introduction to Mastering the Art of French Cooking, first published in 1961, is for the American cook who can be unconcerned with budgets, waistlines, or anything which might interfere with the enjoyment of producing something wonderful to eat. But the 1960s were a decade of enormous culinary conflict. Women entering the workforce in record numbers yearned for ever easier and faster foods to prepare for their families. Frozen bread dough, frozen pie crusts, green giant peas, and Cool Whip all entered the market to make their lives easier. And if they were a little late getting home from work, that problem was easily solved. Snack food options were exploding with the introduction of Pringles, Ruffles, Bugles, Chippos, and Doritos. The Julia Child crowd, however, had a new friend in the White House. Eleanor Roosevelt had served hot dogs to the King of England, and Mamie Eisenhower once plied the King of Greece with toasted Triscuits. But the new First Lady was eager to show off a different side of America. Jackie Kennedy lured a serious chef, Rene Verdun, to Washington so she could regale the president's guests with quenelles and sole veronique, two recipes straight from Julia Child's book. Long before anyone had heard of farm-to-table cooking, Verdun was growing vegetables on the White House roof and herbs in the East Garden. Perhaps that inspired Howard Johnson to hire an equally accomplished French chef to upgrade the food as his iconic chain of American restaurants. Jacques Pepin is one of America's unsung heroes. At Howard Johnson's, Jacques went back to the basics, making everything from scratch. He understood what American food could be. His kitchens turned out 10 tons of fresh hot dogs daily, and he insisted on real potatoes in the clam chowder and real clams in the fried strips. To this day, if you ask me to define American food, the first thing that comes to mind are my memories of those delicious, crisp fried clams. But another thing happened in the 60s that shook up our ideas about food. Congress revamped immigration policy, and that opened the doors to chefs from all over the world. I will never forget my first taste of Thai cooking. Initially, my head exploded. Then tears ran down my face. Then I wanted more and more. The new flavors from China were also a shock. For the first time, cooks from provinces other than Canton entered the country, and we all discovered Szechuan and Hunan food. Is it any wonder that we embarked on a spicy food craze from which we have yet to recover? Last year, Americans spent spent $700 million just on hot sauce. Well, folks, I hate to leave you hanging, but this article is going to have to be done in two parts. So we will end here for today, and next week I will continue with it. Now, let's move on to another article from AARP, the magazine. Medical Breakthroughs 2020. New hope for diabetes, breast cancer, prostate cancer, vision loss, heart disease, and lung disease. First, saving their heart health and ours. Meet some of the courageous patients who have found promise in the latest medical breakthroughs. This is by Sarah Mahoney. Yes, 2020 has been a dark time. The coronavirus crisis exposed plenty of cracks in our national healthcare system, and we lost far too many of our peers and loved ones to an out-of-control pandemic. But as we mourn the losses of this past year, there's a reason for optimism. Not just for an end to the current crisis, but for all of the innovations that have arrived in its wake. The growth in telemedicine and health apps has improved healthcare access for the most vulnerable of us. While manufacturers such as Ford and GM have shown that they can quickly retool to create medical equipment, exposing an opportunity for all companies to explore. So let's take a moment to recognize many of the recent breakthroughs in medical care. Advances that may pave the way for a healthier, happier tomorrow for all of us. And to celebrate the heroic men and women who have helped to make these futuristic treatments a modern reality. Diabetes breakthrough. Treating diabetes with islet cell transplants. Some medical breakthroughs come as lightning bolts, but Randy Fispus-Castor has been riding the slow-moving train of islet cell transplants for an astonishing 15 years. For most of her life, Fispus-Castor was called a brittle diabetic, which meant that her type 1 diabetes caused such severe swings in blood sugar levels that passing out was a frequent occurrence. I used to wear a lot of silver bangles on my arm, so they could hear me when I fainted at work, she says. But since she had her cell transplant in 2005, followed by a bone marrow transplant 10 days later, and an additional islet cell transplant in 2010, that has all changed. She's been free from insulin injections for 10 years, with a blood sugar score on the low side of normal. And she takes just 2 anti-rejection medications per day. Very low for a transplant victim or transplant patient. That has made her a success story of the experimental procedure, which continues to be a major focus at the University of Miami's Diabetes Research Institute. Such transplants are used in other countries, and researchers are awaiting approval from the Food and Drug Administration, which is evaluating trial results. This is an area where the U.S. lags, said Jay Schuyler, MD, Deputy Director of Clinical Research at the Institute. One hurdle for these transplants is finding more sources of insulin-producing cells. Currently, they come from cadavers and are in short supply. We're still limited by only 1,200 cadavers per year, he says. Researchers hope that embryonic or induced stem cells will one day be a source of insulin-producing cells, making the treatments available to both type 1 and type 2 diabetics. Both of Fibocaster's 2005 transplants came from the same cadaver donor, and the 2010 procedure from another. Doctors attribute her exceptional recovery to a high tolerance of the required anti-rejection drugs, which can be an obstacle for many. She can't wait for the day the procedure is cleared for widespread use. I'm so happy this transplant has given me a second chance, she said. And the sidebar article with this says, bariatric surgery can prevent diabetes in very obese people, BMI of 40+. Now data shows it may cause remission in type 2 diabetics with a BMI as low as 30, especially for those with early onset. Now, breast cancer breakthrough, aggressive multidisciplinary therapy to attack an especially dangerous early-stage tumor. After 24 years of perfect mammograms, Cora Sherd, 66, got the call that women dread. She should come in for a retest. The retest in March of 2018 led first to a sonogram, then a biopsy, then a diagnosis, then tears. 2 of her 5 sisters had already had breast cancer, and she knew how scary it could be. After I got the call, I went into my manager's office, and we went down in the chapel, and I prayed, she said. Adding to the fear, Sherd discovered she had a type of cancer known as HER2+/ER+. About a quarter of all breast cancers are HER2+. These tumors have higher levels of a protein called human epidermal growth factor, receptor 2, which tends to make them grow and spread faster than other breast cancers. Researchers have been studying this cancer subtype and have developed new treatment approaches, including an aggressive multidisciplinary therapy that was first proven beneficial in later stages of breast cancer. Several treatments are now available to women with advanced breast cancer, and some are expected to also be incorporated in the early setting, including new treatments that target HER2, explains Verid Stearns, MD, director of the Women's Malignancies Program at the Kimmel Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, which is where Sherd is being treated. First, Sherd got a lumpectomy, with doctors removing 3 lymph nodes as well as the tumor. Next came 20 sessions of chemotherapy, followed by 15 rounds of radiation. The first session was the worst, and I was determined that chemo wasn't taking me down like that, Sherd said. So she began taking better care of herself, looking for ways to build up her immune system including meditation classes, even something called sound meditation, along with Tai Chi and walking. Today, her cancer is in remission. Sherd continues to take one medication daily, Astrazole, which reduces the risk of her breast cancer coming back. Her doctors expect her to be on this drug for between 5 and 10 years. Sherd, who has since retired from her job as a clinical technician, couldn't be more grateful despite ongoing struggles with lymphedema, a common but painful complication of lymph node removal that required physical therapy. "I just leaned into my faith," she says. "My three daughters gave me such strength and support. I even did a mission trip down to Jamaica. And when I lost my hair, I decided to be the baddest chick with the bald head." And the sidebar article on this one says there are several breast cancer treatments that are generating optimism. New studies find that aromatase inhibitors, which reduce estrogen, currently used to prevent recurrence, may prevent breast cancer from developing in the first place. An immunotherapy drug is being tested in combination with the chemotherapy, and it creates a new line of treatment for difficult-to-treat triple-negative cancers. And now we have lung disease. A tiny valve implant that boosts breathing by helping damaged lungs works more efficiently. Jim Hogan's chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, was getting worse, making it hard to finish his weekly golf games or even walk down the driveway. Lucky for him, his golf partner, a doctor, came across a journal article about Zephyr, a lung valve that was generating medical buzz in Europe. When the FDA cleared Zephyr for use in the U.S. in 2018, Hogan lobbied to get insurance coverage for the procedure. Traveling to Temple University Hospital in Philadelphia, the first U.S. center to use the valve to treat severe emphysema. After a few hurdles, his insurance company considered it investigational, and he had to appeal. He had the valve implanted in April of 2019. It's a serious procedure with a device the size of a pencil eraser inserted via a bronchoscope. The one-way valve blocks air from invading the damaged parts of the lungs, where it can get trapped and hinder breathing. "The instant I woke up from anesthesia, I felt the difference," he said. "It took 20 years to develop and gain approval for a treatment," says Gerard Kreiner, MD, director of the Temple Lung Center, where Hogan had his procedure. "It's less invasive than other treatments, it costs less, and it improves exercise function and quality of life." And the sidebar with this, Nuvara is a radio frequency ablation that disrupts nerve signals and dilates the airways. In trials, it reduced COP flare-ups in patients. Good news for 2020 here. And now we have time for a few life lessons from the Queen. At 94, the world's longest reigning monarch still follows these 10 rules for staying vital, says the author of a new book, Long Live the Queen. I'm not sure we'll get through all 10, but we'll give it a start. Recharge your willpower. Elizabeth II's self-control appears limitless because she takes time to replenish it, grasping, as research shows, that willpower is akin to a battery that requires routine recharging. Tea time is that crucial interval for the Queen, a sacred break in her hectic day when she rests for a quiet hour with a fragrant pot of Earl Grey or Darjeeling, and sometimes something sugary. Stick to a schedule. From her first day as Queen, Elizabeth has calmed her mind by following a strict daily regimen, ending each day by writing in her journal. Develop your sense of purpose. The Queen lives for something larger than herself, her country. Studies show having a dedicated cause helps immunity and reduces one's risk of Alzheimer's. Serve others. The patron of hundreds of charities, Elizabeth II, believes that giving herself to good causes can do as much as anything to help me put my own worries into perspective. Her reward, an infusion of an anti-inflammatory hormone. Sweeten the self-talk. I find that I can often put things out of my mind which are disagreeable, the Queen once said. So-called purposeful repressors, people who consciously dial down negative mind chatter, benefit from a kind of psychological armor. As Elizabeth II observed at one point, the trouble with gloom is that it feeds upon itself. Brush aside vanity. From the beginning of her reign, the Queen has made a deliberate effort to practice what behavioral psychologists call self-distancing. She can, with a complete lack of vanity, comb through a daily onslaught of personal stories in the tabloids and still remain a detached and frequently amused spectator. Never stop playing. Elizabeth II still takes time almost every day to play as she loved to as a child, specifically with horses. Doing so has kept her muscles active and her mind remarkably agile, thanks to play's unique ability to suspend the brain in a youthful, flexible state. Keep the faith. The Queen attends church every Sunday and prays every night before bed, grounding rites that have been an essential component of her iconic resilience. Whatever worries the world throws at her, she believes there is a higher throne on which to lay them. Be open to change. At an age when many find it hard to accept altered conditions, Elizabeth II has never stopped learning and adapting. Change has become a constant, she remarked in 2002. The way we embrace it defines our future. And finally, we did make it through all of them. Cherish your crowning years. Elizabeth II smiles more nowadays and is more warmly approachable than ever. All of this supports the scientific phenomenon known as the U-bend of life, the discovery that the world's happiest people tend to be those who are in their 80s and beyond. Well, folks, we've run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is also available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.